Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy from Armature, providing software solutions for conformity assessment, standards, and policy management. Federal Tech Talk is the show that opens up the world of technology to the federal government. Every week, John speaks with public and private sector IT experts to help you understand some of the IT trends and challenges that your agency may be facing. Federal Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, John Gilroy.
Welcome to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio we have Noel Dickover. He's a federal IT consultant from Communibuild Technologies, and Alex Howard, who is a DC-based writer and editor. And today we're going to open up the discussion on open source, open government, and open data, and talk about different aspects of it that we may not have covered previously. Just like to welcome a new sponsor for the show today. Starting today, our show is going to be sponsored by AT&T. And we'll see what that involves. I've got to be careful talking about AT&T now. I got a note to John. Don't talk about AT&T. Say good things or bad things. I normally don't have to worry about these. My sponsors usually are different companies besides companies involved in the technology world. Some people are going, geez, these guys don't work for companies. Are they independent consultants? What are they doing? And how do they have expertise in the federal government? So maybe we can start off by Alex telling you about your background and how you wound up becoming so popular in town here and knowledgeable. And then we'll switch to Noel, please.
Sure. So I actually went to school well over a decade now to study biology and sociology. I was kind of a cliche. I was a fellow who wanted to become a doctor and then ran into chemistry and then went the other direction. And after doing any number of things in my 20s, very much a member of Generation XY, I happened onto technology writing. I became a technology writer and editor at a company called TechTarget in the beginning of 2006. Mm-hmm. And after covering just about everything around enterprise IT, I moved into regulatory compliance reporting, and that brought me to D.C. in the summer of 2009. In the spring of 2010, I joined O'Reilly Media, and instead of writing about all the things that governments and big companies had to do because of laws and regulations, I started writing about what might be possible, so the whole innovation space. And if you think back to that point in the D.C.'s history, there was such excitement about what could be possible with technology. And I've been chronicling it since. I've worked.
And let's hear it. How many followers do you have on Twitter? Come on, let's hear it. What's the number?
Well,
as
of this morning, I think it's 188,800 followers.
Wow, sure. Yeah, that's a lot. That's pretty good. Well, no, that's a tough show. tough one to beat that one, Noel. How about your background?
Well, by the way, I do follow Alex, and it's definitely worth it. If you want to understand what's happening in open government, he's really...
At Digifile, P-H-I-L-E.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Thanks,
he's a terrific follow. So I've been in government contracting since 1994. 2000, I became an independent consultant. I have an undergrad in anthropology, a master's in something called cybernetics and general systems theory. I've done a lot of work in, you know, early on in the reengineering kind of stuff, and moved into online communities, communities of practice, and eventually open government related things. I've worked in 5 different agencies. More recently, I've been very heavy into tech and development. I co-founded an organization called Crisis Commons, which did a whole lot of stuff first with the Haiti disaster, getting volunteer technologists and folks in the open source community working with first responders to, you know, really help folks in need down there through a lot of different ways using the computer. Eventually, we had 15 countries working on that and responded to the Chilean disaster and the Pakistani floods and so forth. So I'm fairly well tied with the open source community, and I've done a whole lot of work overseas in tech and development. So I'm fairly well read on both the open source stuff, but also how that applies to innovation inside of government.
Alex, most of my listeners are federal IT professionals, and what they do is they try to see what guests to have on, and they may be interested in SharePoint or interested in mobile security or interested in agile software development or open government. Mm. And if you're alive and have a pulse and work for the government, you probably heard about the Open Government Initiative that's come up in the last year or so. And here in May, we have a character by the name of Todd Park, who's really beating the drum, and he's just an excitable guy. And I had him in the studio here a week or two ago, and I wanted to take and get maybe a different perspective. You know, if you get someone from the federal government who's a proponent of open government, they're going to say the good things and good things and good things, and you want to be polite and bring up some, you know, alternate opinions. But we can have you guys come in and say, okay, well, here's maybe something that Todd didn't consider, or here's a perspective, or if you're working for an agency, have you thought of X, Y, and Z? And I think that's a good place to start, Alex.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that Open government is not at the federal level and something new, right? In fact, it goes back to Enlightenment thinking, philosophers that founded this country, you know, centuries ago, and that came out of course the kind of philosophy that founded a lot of the European democracies, you know, and goes back to even to the Deimos and the Greeks, you know, the
idea. This is why he has 188,000 followers.
Well, let's be fair here, though. I mean, these are ideas that have really deep philosophical underpinnings, and they've basically now been transplanted and moved into the 21st century. And so the conversation is not necessarily should citizens have some kind of say in what their government does? Should they be accountable to the people? Should they be able to understand how laws and rules are being created in their name, have access to those laws and rules, have access to the courts, but be able to use technology to understand what's happening there and maybe to do a bit more, right? Traditionally, open government has been framed just in terms of transparency and accountability. That is to say, people like members of the press here in WFED saying, we want to know what you're doing. So we're going to use, say, the Freedom of Information Act, something that was passed in the 60s, to ask for certain things. And that's a form of open government, right? There's also this other side, though, too, of around participation and collaboration, something the administration defined in their very first, really, act in government. They put out this memo. Said we're going to try to get you all to do FOIA more often, which has been a huge challenge across government. And we're going to try to get you to collaborate more effectively using some of these wonderful new tools and try to get people to participate as well, with the thinking being that when citizens are more engaged in government, government policies can get better. And that's been something we've been watching now, and you know, members of the media who track this stuff for the past 5 years. What's happened more recently is there's been an executive order and an associated policy to really try to codify with something with the force of law a specific part of this, which is around opening up data and making it machine readable by default. Does not affect the other kinds of open government as much, say around press freedom, something there's a lot of to-do about these days here in D.C. and, of course, abroad. Doesn't necessarily affect the things around citizen participation, engagement, other kinds of open government efforts. But I think what we're seeing now is a bit of maturation in some aspects of it, and certainly the ones the administration sees return on. Transparency is almost always a club that's used against whoever is in office. That's certainly true today if you look at the relationship of congressional Republicans to the administration. And certainly if you see a Republican president, you can expect whoever is sitting in the congressional oversight communities to use transparency as a weapon against them as well.
Noel, we had a little historical framework there and brought us up to date. Now, you can bring in a unique international perspective on this and maybe talk about, you know, is this unique to the federal government in the United States? Are other companies doing this? Is this a model in Europe or not modeled? And what about interagency concerns about transparency?
So I think the whole open government movement, which in the Obama administration has done great on putting forward, has really propagated out. There's something called an open government partnership where there's a whole number of countries now engaged, and there's a set of standards that they have to do in order to become a member of this partnership. By and large, it's really tackling corruption worldwide through transparency methods and through this notion of citizen engagement. And so we've been on this path here, you know, since the administration came in office. And I think, you know, back to your point about, you know, from an insider perspective in some way, there's been some hiccups. So, you know, we created this thing called data.gov, which was, you know, give us your data sets, put them in a public forum for everybody to use. You know, working in an agency at the time, you would sort of get these calls, give us X number of data sets per month. And so we did that. We went for the low-hanging fruit. We got data sets out there. But we passed over the part that Alex was talking about, this participation and collaboration, in what you ended up in some cases were whole bunches of data sets that nobody ever saw or cared about versus engaging with whatever constituent group from your agency, asking them what they really cared about, and then going and finding the data sets that would matter. And so I think part of this open data policy is a reset, and the really cool part about it is it's saying – the default position now is you're supposed to be making things that are both machine readable and that at some point in the future the public could consume. So this notion that the data inside of an agency is in effect owned by the public and they should have access to it is a fairly unique thing. You know, a lot of the other parts of interoperability, you know, open data standards, that's been in there since Clinger-Cohen Act.
know, I'm listening to you, and I flashed on a movie called Raiders of the Lost Ark, and that last scene where they go to this huge government warehouse, and, and okay, we're going to make this available. We're just going to tell you where it's at. And so what Alex says is, okay, they've actually taken the warehouse and opened the doors to the warehouse, and now there's the other part is giving people tool sets to find the information. What about engaging with innovators? What about engaging with entrepreneurs?
That is a terrific analogy. In just if you're in government and you have that massive warehouse, which, in fact, I think we do.
In Temple Hills, Maryland.
Well, in every agency, the funding for IT purchases, IT acquisitions, doesn't come always from the same place. And there's different parts in the agency producing different things. So to get a handle on what's actually there and to even know about it is an incredibly difficult thing internally.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to force Alex to define open government, open source, and open data, and then run from there.
Nice.
You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy.
You want the definitions page here?
On Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're speaking with Noel Dickover, an independent consultant, and Alex Howard, a D.C.-based writer and editor. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. In the studio today, Noel Dickover, an independent consultant, and he's affiliated with Communibuild Technologies. Alex Howard, a D.C.-based writer and editor. Both of these gentlemen kind of active on social media. For Noel, it's at Noel Dickover. That's easy to spell. And for Alex, it's at Digifile, D-I-G-I-P-H-I-L-E, at Digifile. Well, before the break, I was about to twist Alex's arm and force him to define something. So I'm just going to figuratively twist his arm here. You got open government, you got open source, open data. Give some guidelines for our listeners who maybe are kind of familiar with it or, you know, just maybe trying to get some detail on the differences, please.
Okay. Well, that's a lot of open in there.
Got to open up the discussion.
Yeah, opens the thing. So I'll start with open government since that's probably the oldest thing. We talked about that a bit in the last block, but it's basically a governing philosophy which says that citizens have the right to access government information and to have access to the government, should be able to petition their government, should be able to know what's happening inside of the governing bodies that make the decisions that govern their lives. And that's something that goes back, as I mentioned before, to the time of the European Enlightenment, when we were talking about how we construct democratic societies, and should say basically that citizens should be stakeholders in the operations, the laws, the rules, the regulations, the rest of the things that affect their lives.
I would maybe even say go further, the citizens have a responsibility to help co-create government and to provide services as well, versus looking at it as an independent entity that just does stuff. Citizens need to roll up their sleeves and help them do it better.
If it's governed by the people, they should have a thermometer.
This is interesting. So what Noel just introduced is, I think, a more recent, if you will, iteration of open government, which takes something from open source, where people have an opportunity to actually affect the code behind a piece of software. And that's an idea that goes back to, I think, say, the 1970s, and start to look at the free software movement, which then evolved in something called open source software. My former publisher, Tim O'Reilly, and a number of other people in California came together and tried to call this something a little bit different, very similar bits. And you can go and actually read whole books and treatises about the differences between open source software and free software. But the basic idea here is the code behind the software itself is shared, usually in an online repository, and can be downloaded and forked, right, changed. And then depending upon the license itself, those changes can be added back to the original code itself to make the thing better. Now, this was a crazy idea at that point in, say, in the 80s and 90s. People weren't sure about if you shared the code, what would happen. Well, what actually has happened is that the open source operating systems like Linux or open source software like Apache have gone on to power some of the most important stacks in the world.
And secure,
Web servers to Google's data centers, to Facebook's data centers. Now to the software frameworks, which let us handle so-called big data. Things like Hadoop are open source.
And open data, then, is?
Open data is actually, and we'll actually pull this straight from the policy here, which Noel's got in front of me, and I actually like this, is refers to publicly available data structured in a way that enables the data to be fully discoverable and usable by end users. And, I mean, effectively.
And machine readable.
This is a more recent addition to the canon. But it's essentially saying that here's data. It's open for anyone to download, to use, to remix. In an ideal world, to make it more liquid and available to developers, and you make it machine readable. So you put it into formats like XML or at the other really kind of high-end things like Sparkle and linked open data. And the thinking here is if you make the data more interoperable, then it can basically be baked into services in all kinds of ways.
From theory to practice, here it is, May 2013. A bunch of medical records were released about charges. What we found is hospitals in Florida were charging X for knee surgery, and the hospital across the street was charging X plus $10,000. I mean, so is this a good example? Is this open government, open sources? Is this what the proponents wanted? They said, finally, transparency. We can find out what hospitals are charging.
Yeah, there's this notion of situational awareness, and you know, it's usually applied to organizations, but in this case, if citizens could actually find out what things cost and why, and finding in some cases, like you said, there's no basis for it. That does prompt change. And I think that's a lot of the impetus behind this. The other ones, you'll find, you know, we've done this in the federal government for a long time. You look at weather.com, you're accessing an open data set that was released by the federal government. If you use, you know, a map on your phone, that's using the satellites, the GPS satellites, that again are open and available. So I think there's a lot of benefits to open data, but I think that the challenge, and if you look in a lot of the discussions, it's in some cases sold as a panacea. I mean, Todd Park is awesome. I love him. He's the most energetic speaker I can think of in the federal government, and you need a leader like that to really get this forward. But the open data sets in and of themselves don't solve problems, right? There's needs associated, and if one of the needs are what's the cost of healthcare treatments, you know, and in some cases that's, you know, broken because you have this insurance company in the middle, but if you have that need, the open data can really make a difference to it. In some cases, you can build what are called apps to really address that. In other cases, it's just really you know, a map or some kind of product that shows you what's occurring in a way that maybe you didn't see before.
I think that that's important. You're saying that the data actually has to be put to use, and that's accurate. You know, in this case, pricing data just put on the line in a JSON, you know, file. Okay, great. How many citizens actually go to HHS.gov and download it? Now, if you put that into an interactive map or into a service which lets them search, now you have something interesting.
And we're that's getting, the tale of what Todd's trying to do, the next step.
We're getting close to a holy grail here, right? The number one data that people care about when it comes to going to get healthcare is still, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, whether something takes their insurance or not. Then they'll look for quality. Then they'll look for pricing. You put all three of those together, then you actually have something that will enable you to navigate your world. Right. And in every case, navigation is actually a great metaphor. You think about the little glowing blue dot on Google Maps. Think about that analogy applied to education or to consumer finance or to healthcare. In the same way, open data sets can help you to navigate making a decision.
No, I'm going to put this in work boots for you now. We had Terry Mulholland in here from the IRS. They have a lot of data sets, don't they? Now, some citizen sitting in Tulsa is going to be very wary of their information being exposed. And so it's one thing to have open government, open data, but you have to worry about privacy and security. And what about those people in the intelligence community? They may be a little wary of sharing information, too. So, you know, we have the ideal here, but then there's some practical aspects, too.
Yeah, imagine you're somebody in government that's received this policy. It's all well and good, and you see the cheers from the Open Government Community and Sunlight Foundation and folks like that. And now you're actually stuck looking at all the different IT systems in your agency. If it is a national security system, does that mean you can't pull anything from it, or is there still something you can extract? If there's privacy information in there, again, what's the question? What do you do with it? Do you shelve it and try to go for something easier? It's an incredibly complex thing. What's the implication to records management in the rest of it? In the notion that you have an IT system that's both collecting data and, in some cases, creating data, that in and of itself doesn't define a clear data set, which is really what you're supposed to be releasing to the public.
We take a break and come back, talk more about open data, and maybe talk about social media and how you can learn more, especially with concepts involving open government here. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, Noel Dickover, federal IT consultant, and Alex Howard, D.C.-based writer and editor. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are speaking with Noel Dickover, independent consultant, and Alex Howard, a D.C.-based writer and editor. We're opening up the conversation on open government. We're talking about open source and open data. You know, many of my listeners are, they only listen to one type of show. They just may only listen to shows about Red Hat, or only shows about Microsoft, or only shows about open government, open source. And in addition to this interview, they may click around the internet and look for different things. And so Alex, do you have a blog? Do you can recommend some blogs for our folks to maybe get more information from?
Sure. So I have a number of blogs. I've been, I think I was blogging previously at the O'Reilly Radar for the past 3 years, and there's a huge archive of my work there, radar.oreilly.com/AlexH. If you just Google Alex Howard, a lot of this stuff will turn up. You can find digifile.wordpress.com. I started a news site within the past 3 weeks, e-pluribusunum.com, where I've been putting a lot of open government, open data posts. I also have a column at the Huffington Post. I've contributed to a site called GovFresh, gov2o.govfresh.com.
He's everywhere. Slate.
I've
read your piece in Slate.
Great. Thank you. I've literally written, hundreds and hundreds of pieces over the last couple of years. And there's a lot of it that goes in social media too, right? Yeah. I mean, if it were 10 years ago, a lot of the things that I put out as tweets, and I've written, whatever it is, near 80,000 of these things, they might have been blog posts in of themselves.
Yeah.
That's how I use Twitter as a microblog. And I also use Google Plus, right, which is Google's social network, social layer. And a lot of the things I put into Google Plus look a lot like a blog post.
Yeah.
And if you look for google.com/plus Alexander Howard, we'll get that profile as well.
And there's a whole argument on Slate about what is a blog and what's a blog post.
Well, I could define that. That's a little easier. But,
I'll be blogging about this. If you want to find my blog, you just type John Gilroy blog and it pops up. It's pretty easy. What about you, Noel?
So I'm nowhere near as prolific, unfortunately. I do every now and then post a GovLoop, like my thoughts on the new open data policy, or in a past life I was a principal author the draft policy that got soldiers to be able to use Facebook and YouTube and so forth. And I think GovLoop is a terrific place for folks to do things on there. Outside of myself, a blog that I love to follow if you're interested at all in the changes of the crisis response world, and really there's just some amazing changes. Patrick Myers, iRevolutionNet, is a terrific source.
M-Y-E-R-S?
I'm sorry?
How do you spell his name?
M-E-I-E-R.
Yeah. Oh, good thing I asked.
Yep.
And radio, that's important.
I should plug some other blogs, too, as long as you're being generous with that. I'd say I go to Tech President. Of course, I read the Sunlight Foundation's blogs. They're following this stuff. The Open Knowledge Foundation. I read a fellow named David Eves, who follows open data and open government very closely. And then there's a whole passel of people here in town who are focused on these things. I think Joseph Marks at NextGov is a pretty good reporter.
And I'm not going to leave out Rob Pigoraro. He's a fascinating writer, and I read his stuff all. It's one that I follow.
Yes.
Okay, let's back to the work boots and Noel and the work boots here. So we got an agency, and they're reading all this stuff from the White House, and they're getting their arms twisted, and so they want to release some data sets. They have to start off, I guess, with some a repository or an enterprise data repository. That's first base, isn't it?
Yeah, they're talking about creating and maintaining an enterprise data inventory, and this is supposed to lead to a public listing of the data sets that are available inside an agency, whether or not they're released. It just the work that's associated with that, it assumes up front that you've already done portfolio management, you already have a listing of all your IT programs, and that you know what they produce, which I'm sorry to say is not the case. If it was the case, you wouldn't have redundant IT systems. The fact that we still have that means it's an incredibly difficult undertaking, especially in the larger agencies. But once you have that part, you then need to look at each system, determine what's being created, what's being collected. Is there a data set there, and what would I do with it? And again, it's the NSS concerns and the privacy concerns, compounded again that money doesn't fall from one space. It's across swath, so there's no one person usually who has a good handle on this. Bottom line, this is an incredibly difficult thing, first to create the data inventory and then to do a public listing of the data sets, whether or not the public can access this. And so the concern I would have, in a nutshell, folks like Sunlight Foundation and others who are incredibly excited about this, a year later, when not very much is done, because it's incredibly difficult and there's no money for it, are they going to be as happy with this? And so then what do you do in the meantime, right? And it gets back to what we were talking about before about needs. So maybe agencies should be doing sort of this dual track where on one hand, yes, they're starting to try to get a handle on the data that's produced in what they can do with it. But on the other hand, they should be starting right away with engaging with their constituent groups, whoever it is. Each agency will have a group of folks in different groups who are interested in what they do, and actually ask them, what are the needs? What are you trying to get out of this?
You know, Alex, I love the word interoperability, just like saying it in the radio. It's a good radio word. But this is an issue. This is a question. A lot of systems are interoperate and interconnected, and there's this thing we talked about in the earlier block about unexpected outcomes. So Agency A decides to open up some data and mistakenly doesn't realize that it's interconnected to something else. It allows someone to develop a profile or a mosaic on someone, and what was initially desired, privacy and security, its unintended consequences, is foiled, isn't it?
Well, the potential for that is there, and that's why you had something referenced in this policy called the mosaic effect, which is to say you put together lots of different kinds of data sets that in themselves might not create a security or privacy issue, but when put many together, it will. And this actually concerned quite a few people who work in the open government space, particularly, I must say, journalists who actually deal with government data on a day-to-day basis and have been slogging it out now for decades trying to get data back. We should take a step back and I think recognize here there's a couple things about this policy. One is that it turns the default to being more open. It's in terms of saying that unless there's a reason to hold this back, the presumption is that you shall make this more open and machine readable. And that's important in the context of the historical moment we're in. I mean, we're talking here in D.C., but you know, listeners far and wide know that government secrecy has been expanding. The amount of documents that are classified has been expanding. The national security state, if you want to call it that, has been expanding. And that people's civil liberties are under threat as well. So this isn't just a question about whether better apps or services can be provided. This is actually whether the American people and, frankly, the rest of the world, which looks upon us as the remaining superpower, have any kind of ability to hold the operations and choices of people who are in power accountable. And this is something that our founding fathers were, frankly, pretty concerned about. You know, they had an understanding that power, which is really what this is all about, who has the data, who has the information, who's making the decisions, what can the data tell us about those decisions, get to do it in secret or not. And some of this data is, you know, beyond, say, what's happening on the regulatory level. That's very interesting. It goes to budgeting and spending. Core operations of government, and those things aren't released yet in the way they could be.
So just a different tact on the mosaic effect. The problem with that is nobody is able to recognize it until 2 or 3 or 4 years after the fact.
Happens,
there's not this magical moment where everybody says, wait a second, if you add that data set, look what happens. It's something where after it's already out and people have commented on it for 2 years, you realize, oh, wait, we went too far. So in practice, inside an agency, what you get are – for lack of a better term, the gatekeepers, the ones who are really worried about this and don't know the impact, will use that as almost a cudgel to not release anything because they're not sure. And the truth of the matter is, nobody really is sure, right? I mean, it's not something where there's a clear formula that says, you're coming close to the mosaic
unexpected
effect.
It
is. So, you know, from that standpoint, yes, we understand that, but I don't know that you can make that very operative in the sense of actually deciding which data set to release.
I would push back a little bit on what you said in the sense that I have actually seen some of that magic happen. There's an organization called Palantir.
Great organization.
Right?
Yeah.
Which allows you to visualize lots of data sets. And they've actually been deployed to look for Medicaid fraud, which, of course, we know there's a lot of out there.
Now, Florida? Did you say Florida?
You know, and they combine many different data sets and visualize them on a network. And what's fascinating is you start to see them pull in, you know, open data, but then they also pull in proprietary data and data from the criminal databases, and all of a sudden you get this three-dimensional profile, and you can see where the nodes of fraud are.
But take that from the perspective of an agency who has no money to do this. Palantir doesn't work for free. And if I'm releasing something in justice, how do I know that something in labor completely independent when combined now adds this new piece? It's a complex system phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's not something that – from an individual point, you could figure out. You could figure out later, or if you have a big pot of money that, you know, maybe folks like the Intel community and others might have, you can ask the Palantir to look at it. But most agencies, that's just not going to be in the equation.
I mentioned piles of money. That's why we have sponsors. We got to take a break. You're listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, speaking with Noel Dickover, independent consultant, and Alex Howard, a D.C.-based writer and editor. We're talking about open government. Welcome back to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, Noel Dickover, independent consultant, and Alex Howard, D.C.-based writer and editor. Glad you guys took a break from your argument in the break to talk about technology. A lot of my listeners read blogs. We talked about blogs earlier. A lot of my listeners follow people on Twitter. I sure follow a lot of people. My Twitter handle is at Ray Gilroy. And Alex, you want to punch yours up again?
Sure. It's Digifile, D-I-G-I-P-H-I-L-E.
Right. Lots of folks following that. And just your name, Noel Dickover, is that right?
Yes, only about 3,000 followers, so I'm about 185,000 short.
We'll catch up by the end of the show, you know, that's for sure. So you're working for an agency like Department of Interior, and you decide you have a need. Let's start with the needs here, and how do you negotiate open data for a specific agency like we talked about earlier?
So Interior, and I haven't worked in that, so that's a great example. There's going to be a number of data systems across that. And so where to start? Do you do the internal, you know, cataloging and assuming you've gotten a good set of, you know, systems? Do you do the data reference model approach, which they're advocating? I would never do that, but that's a separate aside. We can talk about it if you want. But instead, here's a thought. Why don't you work with the groups that care about the interior? Ask them what they're interested in. What type of questions or needs do they have? Take that, find out the data systems that are associated with it, and go to those data owners and try to release data sets associated with that. So instead of sort of this back, you know, office process of identifying all the data sets and eventually putting them out on this repository, which can be going in parallel, actually engage your constituents, find out what they need, and get those high-value data sets out as quick as possible. That I think, is going to be really, you know, make the biggest difference as fast as you can.
Start with the end in mind. I remember Stephen Covey came up with that. Now's the time in the show where everyone has to take a 10-question test. Vince Cerf took this test. Everyone's got to take this test. And a lot of people are listening going, geez, that Alex guy, what kind of a phone does he have? And so I'm going to answer the question right here by asking you 10 questions. Start off with Alex. Age when you purchased your first PC, how old were you?
When I purchased it?
Yep.
That would be at 17. I had a PC long before that, but my uncle bought me an Apple II Plus when I was 7.
When you bought your first cell phone, how old were you?
1999, so let's see, that would make me 22.
Okay, and you have your own personal Twitter feed, we know that, personal blog, we know that.
Yep.
Do you use any personal backup services online?
I have used Mozy, I have used Backupify.
You get the check mark on that.
All right.
And what kind of smartphone do you have?
I have an iPhone 5 with an R2-D2 case.
R2-D2 case. He's proud of that, too. Number of apps on that bad boy?
Oh, I have well over 100 at this point.
And I used to ask if you have a tablet device, but now how many tablet devices do you have in your home?
We have a couple. We've iPad 2. We've got a Kindle.
Just like mine is, yeah.
A baby on the way, and I think there'll be an iPad 4 sometime soon.
Yeah.
As well.
And social networks you participate in?
Oh, boy. Let's see. Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Tumblr, Pinterest.
Got them all. Okay. Eli, he got them all. Checklist. He's got the checklist. The last book you read, was it paper or electronic?
That would be paper, actually. Moses Naim's Power Book. Yeah, I like to read a lot of books in paper form. I do have hundreds of e-books that I've read over the years, but I also have a pretty substantial library.
Well, Noel, let's see if you can whoop them on this one. Who's the bigger nerd? How old were you bought your first PC?
18. I bought a laptop that had no hard drive in, I guess, 1985.
No hard drive. My kids aren't going to believe that.
And I took out a loan for $2,000 to get it.
Whoa, you are the dangerous guy. When did you get your first cell phone? What age?
Oh, gosh. Well, so I'm like 46, 47 now, so it wasn't when I first – when did I get my first cell phone? I'm going to say early 2000s, but I honestly do not remember the
– And you got a personal Twitter feed, and you
yes.
have your own blog, and do you use personal online backups?
Yeah, I do. Dropbox. I actually have a different site for my picture SmugMug, which I like a lot, and they actually have a back-end data set as well.
What kind of smartphone you have?
A Samsung Galaxy S3.
Oh, that's interesting. And number of apps on that?
Way more than I could ever count.
More than you can count. And the number of tablet devices that float around your house there.
So I gave my wife my Motorola Zoom, which I bought the first day it came out. I now have the Asus Transformer, the Infinity, the latest one. My son has a nice little tablet from Amazon. So I guess three.
Three. Good.
What
social network sites you're active in?
A bunch of different ones, Twitter primarily, Facebook. I do a number of different sports ones, so forth, but nowhere near the extent that Alex is. He's definitely...
Now, here's a question. Last book you read, paper or electronic?
Definitely electronic. I visited over 20 countries in the last 2 years and massive amount of reading on my little Nooklow tab. Oh, the Nooklow, if you count that as a tablet also.
Yeah. I'm going to have to get my slide rule out and compare you two and come up with a, you know... I'll be a deeming
but, okay,
authority.
So here's the nerd thing that totally wins.
You're going to whoop him on nerd points,
he's
huh?
He's going to try.
FantasyPumpkins.com.
That is way nerdy.
The best sci-fi fantasy pumpkin carver in the world, almost. Fox News does live broadcasts from my house on Halloween. George Lucas has commented
on
proud
of this.
DC2 pumpkin. Absolutely.
You got to see
you got a problem?
Your listeners should go check out fantasypumpkins.com, or they should just Google Death Star Pumpkin.
Death Star Pumpkin.
And you'll see his work. He's been featured in, you know, big
Washington
blogs,
Post like, magazine last
time. Well, if you were nerdy, how about you on the Boing Boing reference?
Well, yeah.
The Wired and Boing Boing stuff plays to the nerd crowd more than Fox or Washington Post. Let's be clear here.
We've got to reel this conversation in and talk more about open government instead of pumpkins. I think we got a real bad. This isn't the pumpkin hour. This is the Federal Tech Talk hour. Let's talk about the future here. Alex, are you optimistic? What's going to happen next 5 to 10 years when your child is born, when they're 10, 11 years old? Are they going to look at just a mess downtown? Is it going to be open and secure? What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think actually, the physical security of the mall is something I do think about fairly frequently. I'm all of 4 blocks away from the Capitol, and when things get locked down, I see it. We have a freedom of assembly, but, the question is under what circumstances? We have freedom of speech under what circumstances? I'd like to believe that all of those liberties will be protected in the years ahead. I think it's going to take a lot of concerted effort by the press and by citizens and by people of good faith in Congress and in the agencies to use their discretion to maintain those things. Fundamentally, I tend to be optimistic about the world. I read a lot of science fiction, and so I've seen the dystopian possibilities, and there are lots of ways things could go wrong. But I do think that my child in 10 years will have a wealth of information at her fingertips, which will hopefully help her to be empowered to make better decisions even at that age. I am concerned about some of the trends I see around securitization, but we'll see.
No.
One other blog I forgot to mention. I've reviewed about 150 cyberpunk movies on cyberpunkreview.com, which also probably gets some nerd cred. A separate thing. But in terms of the future, I'm insanely excited about the developing world. You're looking at just an incredible movement. This is where open government is really making the difference. And you're seeing just some wonderful ways of citizens binding together, creating citizen-generated data sets, and real change in countries which really need it the most. So in terms of what's happening that it's exciting with open data and open government, to me, it's worldwide. We already have so much that's released that we don't even think – we don't have to figure out what the property values are around our neighborhood before creating a restaurant. So many places that's hidden information that you have to pay for. And so the impact of the open government movement worldwide I think is incredible and is making huge strides.
That's a really good point, and I agree with you in the sense that there are so many countries which have had information in great scarcity. And what's been happening over the last 3 or 4 years is you can see this combination of social networking, mobile devices, streaming video, and then data being generated by it and being accessible through these things coming into places where you've had traditionally autocratic governments. People's access to one another has really changed the dynamic. Power is still the thing. The people who control the guns still have the ability to do quite a bit, but if they cannot shoot everybody in the country, if everyone in the country decides to get upset and revolt. Now, what happens afterwards is pretty messy. And as we're seeing it happen in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya, and maybe you see in Syria, see across Southeast Asia. But the change that I think is brought by all of us having
Citizen journalists.
Yep, connected phones makes a big difference. I always say citizen reporting because I think journalism is the act of telling truth, and not everyone who has access to the ability to report something will tell the truth. They'll always tell their version of it. I think journalists add an additional layer of checking, of verification, of saying, this is what we know. This is, the who, what, when, why, how. And citizens don't necessarily do that, but they can certainly make reports of text and video.
10 seconds here, Noel, if you want to comment on that?
No, I think actually that's true, but a lot of citizens are learning to become journalists in the same way a lot of citizens are learning to become great photographers, and a lot of the barriers between those professions have dropped.
Yeah.
Great. You've been listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today in the studio, we had a discussion about open government with Noel Dickover, independent consultant, and Alex Howard, a D.C.-based editor and writer. Thanks, gentlemen.
Listening to Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy of the Armature Corporation, providing consulting, application development, and business productivity solutions on the Microsoft platform. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal Tech Talk, Tuesday mornings at 11, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.